Hey friends, welcome to Worry Less, Wag More. This is the Behavior Bets podcast. I'm your host, Ferdy Yao. Join me to dive into the thrills and challenges of treating pet behavior issues. I'll shine a light on science-based training that's effective and brings us closer to understanding the animals we share our lives with. Hello, everyone. Thank you and welcome back. It seems like at the start of this year, we have a neuroscience slant to our podcast. And I think there's a good reason for that. I think I am, as a dog trainer, been learning so much about training and behavior and observing dogs from the watching their phenotype, basically, just watching what I see. And I've always been so fascinated about what goes on underneath the hood, so to speak, okay? Now I'm really learning so much more about neuroscience. It's so fascinating to hear about how the brain works, how the nervous system works, and how this actually is helping me become a better trainer. So our guest today is another fascinating neuroscientist. Her name is Dr. Paula Croxon. Dr. Croxon is a behavioral and cognitive neuroscientist, science communicator, and storyteller. Dr. Croxon is a freelance public engagement specialist and consultant working with academics and nonprofits to communicate science with the public in meaningful and effective ways. She is also an adjunct assistant professor in neuroscience at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai and a consultant for Columbia University. And she is senior producer for the Story Collider, which is a podcast that we'll tell you a little bit more about later, and is passionate about sharing science with as many people as possible. Hey, Dr. Croxon, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Thank you so much for having me on the show. I am very good. Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you for your time here. I really got interested in interviewing you after watching your webinar on memories that was actually done through Behavior Vets. So we'll post that link up in the show notes. And there's so much in there that was so interesting that I really want to ask you about. And as I was telling you before we got on, I wasn't really sure where to start. But right. You know what we'll do is I'm gonna ask you one of the first questions or one of the first topics you kind of talked about in your webinar, because I kind of found this kind of interesting. So the question is, what is the difference between learning and memory?
That's a great question, and I'm going to give a very unsatisfying answer to it, which is that we don't really know. And the reason for that is because as scientists, when we're trying to understand behavior, so my training is as a behavioral and cognitive neuroscientist, so I'm really interested in the neural basis of behavior. And so in order for me to study a particular behavior in the lab, I have to try and isolate it. I have to try and study it in a sort of isolation of other types of behavior. So the trouble with learning and memory is that it's almost impossible to have one occurring without the other. We actually have similar problems studying attention in the brain as well, because it's very hard to test somebody's memory if you're asking them not to attend to something. There's only a certain range of things that we can test. And so quite often when I'm talking, and probably I'll do this today when I'm talking to you, is that I'll use learning and memory interchangeably. So learning is really the process of us acquiring knowledge about the world. And that can be incremental or it can be in large jumps. And I can't really think of a way to test that without some formation of memory occurring. And so you can almost think of one thing happening as a result of the other and vice versa. So sometimes when I say memory, I'm also talking about learning. And sometimes when I say learning, I'm also talking about memory. Not every neuroscientist might agree with me on that. But that's definitely my opinion is it's very hard to separate the two.
Yeah, I can see that. There's such a great area about it because, right, it's like learning is about something you remember or right. And a past experience that you learned something from that. So I can see that gray area could be hard to kind of separate.
Right. And one thing I'll add really quickly is that both can either be conscious processes or unconscious processes. So you can have types of memory that you don't necessarily have a memory of forming that memory, but you still have remembered something. And likewise, you can have learning occurring without you necessarily consciously knowing that you're acquiring that learning. So that's not even a distinction that's useful to us. But it's pretty cool facet of both, that there are conscious and unconscious processes that can happen.
You know, I'm wondering, like, I try to think about what my first memory is. So as humans, when do we develop the ability to form memories?
So, I mean, probably from the very beginning, from birth. But it seems as if the major roadblock with memory for us humans throughout our lives is not necessarily the formation of memories, the laying down of those memories, but the retrieval of them. And that's really when we can test memory, because it's very, very difficult for us to test memory explicitly by asking somebody, for example, in kids under a certain age. But there are things that we can do in order to test. And of course, for everybody who's interested in animals, some of these techniques are going to be useful for that as well. There is an age at which we start to have this more explicit kind of memory. It's usually, I think, around sort of age 3 or 4 in human children. But even before that, we can test that kind of memory for, you know, have you encountered something before, for example. So let's say we're interested in whether a baby can remember a new toy and recognize it as their toy or a toy that they've interacted before. We can't ask them that because they haven't yet developed language, but what we can do is a test called a preferential looking test. So we can invite the parent to come in with the baby, sit in such a way that they're not cueing the baby by indicating to the baby where to look, and present the baby with a choice of two things to look at. So, for example, a new toy that they've never seen before and a familiar toy. And by and large, babies and animals tend to look more at things that are new, that are unfamiliar, because there's more to explore there. There's more, in essence, to learn there. And so we can actually probe memory in much earlier stages than we can ask somebody, oh, do you remember playing with this before? Now, there are many, many different kinds of memory. So I think when you're thinking about your earliest memory, you are quite naturally thinking of a memory from one of your life events.
Yes.
And that's a very specific, quite complex kind of memory. And that's the kind of memory that usually takes a little longer to at least to be able to be retrieved. And I don't think we have as much evidence, because it's very hard to probe that kind of memory without explicitly asking about it. That kind of memory tends to emerge at the age of around 3 or 4 years old in children. So it's really, really unlikely that you have memories from when you were sort of like 1 or 2 years old of like life occurrences happening. Now, having said that, some of us do. And so I often get people saying, no, that's not true. I have a memory from when I was a baby. And sometimes those memories are actually false memories. They're memories that we have sort of acquired later in life and then attributed back to that time. So I actually have a memory like this. I have a really, really vivid memory of being about 18 months old, being on a plane, traveling to what was then Yugoslavia, and looking out of the window of the plane and seeing my first ever view, you know, of being in flight. And that did happen. And it's incredibly unlikely that I remember that actual event. My parents told me about that trip many times. I've been on planes since, and I know what that looks like. Even before I'd been on a plane, I'd seen movies and images of that. And so it's very likely that I've pieced that together. A tricky thing about memory, because sometimes with these early memories, we don't know exactly whether they're real or false. And in fact, in general, we don't always know what's real in our memories, because it's very hard to distinguish. You know, if you've had a similar thing happen before, you might have incorporated some of that. And so sometimes it's easy to tell. Like I had a person tell me once about a memory that they had where it was one of their kids was looking at a photograph and saying, "Oh, I remember that day. It's really, it was a really fun, brilliant day." And it was, you know, before they were born. And so, so it can't have happened to them because they weren't around yet, but they still had a really great memory of it because they'd seen that photo every day. So sometimes you can tell. Sometimes it's much harder to tell what's real memory and what's a false memory. And of course, that presents all kinds of problems for us and challenges for us and interesting things that we can study.
I see that. It sounds like it's almost like the brain wants to piece together, you know, little pieces of information, and that forms a memory that makes you feel like, oh, you actually experienced it. That's kind of crazy to kind of think about that.
It's a lot.
Okay. Well, you know what? You know, that actually, as at least my next question for you, as a neuroscientist who's particularly interested in memory, do memories, like, do you think, like, do memories make us who we are? I feel like without memories, would we be, you know, ourselves, right?
Right. Yeah, so I think it's very hard to imagine having a self without having this kind of memory. And again, I think when we're talking about memories here, we're probably talking about these life memories. So these autobiographical memories. Yeah, so there's lots and lots of different kinds of memory that can be broken down into different groups. And again, one of the reasons for doing that is because of the way that scientists do our work. So in order to study these things, as I said before, it's useful to be able to kind of isolate these different things. And there's all kinds of ways to do that. And so one of the ways to do that is, you know, can we come up with a lab test that would probe for this but not for this? So can we come up with a test that tests short-term forms of memory versus long-term forms of memory? Yes, right? We can test somebody's recollection quickly after or a long time after. Another way that we tend to break down types of memory as neuroscientists is whether they have different neural underpinnings. So are there different collections of brain regions working together that underlie these different kinds of memory? But the really interesting memories to us as human beings, of course, are the ones that are often thought of as the most complex forms of memory, these autobiographical memories from our lives. And the scientific term for those memories is episodic memories. So that term was coined by a Canadian psychologist called Enel Tolving a very long time ago. And it's been in common use ever since. And it describes these very particular memories for our life events that are these sort of what happened, where and when kind of memories. So a good example of an episodic memory is me remembering the first time I went to Paris with my school band, and how we went on a very too hot day to play music under the Eiffel Tower. And we were really embarrassed because we hadn't been expecting to perform in public. And a really good example of another long-term memory that is not episodic is me having the knowledge that the Eiffel Tower is in Paris. And I could have learned that at any time. I don't really remember when I learned that. Doesn't really matter when I learned that. And it's a piece of factual knowledge, which is also declarative in that I can talk about it in the same way that I can talk about my episodic memories. But it doesn't contain all of that richness of detail. I might just know what the Eiffel Tower looks like and some other facts about it collected together, as opposed to having this rich sensory memory. And one other really cool thing about episodic memories, before I ask you to remind me what the question was, is that we don't try and remember them. So I might have had to learn a number of capital cities of different countries and some features about them when I was in school. And I might have had to learn that stuff over and over again to take a test or something. But with our episodic memories, it's very rare that anyone tells us we're going to be tested on them.
Yeah. Right.
But if I asked you what you had for breakfast this morning, you could probably tell me what you had, roughly what time it was, where you were, who you were with, whether you liked it or not, how you were feeling. And you probably didn't sit down, unless it was a very special day, planning to remember any of that information. So it's a really powerful form of memory because it collects all of this detail together. And sometimes one tiny facet can trigger it. So if you say Paris to me, that might cause the whole memory to come flooding back. There are some really, really powerful things that can bring these memories back. And smells, for example, are one of them. Sometimes a single smell can bring back a whole memory of a person or an experience.
It's really interesting you say that, because I've heard before that smell is the sense that's most strongly connected to memory. And I don't really know what that actually means, but is there any truth to that?
There is some truth to that.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's a little bit to do with the fact that the network of brain regions that underlies this kind of episodic memory is very, very closely coupled with, so there are sort of cognitive sort of serving brain areas. And there's also a circuit in the brain called the limbic system. And the limbic system is a collection of areas. They're not all in the cortex of the brain, which we tend to think of as like the more recently evolved, most complex part of the brain. But there are also subcortical areas that are very important. They're not necessarily less sophisticated, but they evolved longer ago, which means they're more conserved across species, because the further back you go in evolutionary time, the more likely you are to share an ancestor with multiple other species, right?
Yes, yes.
So, and that matters to me as a neuroscientist who used to work on lots of different animals, not just humans, is that I might be able to study those brain areas in all kinds of animals going back in the evolutionary time. I might have shared an ancestor with reptiles and mammals and birds. And so these subcortical areas tend to be more conserved between animals, more shared between animals. And a lot of those areas are involved in the limbic system. And they're very closely coupled to a lot of senses, but smell is particularly closely linked to the limbic system. And it seems to elicit really strong emotional responses. Now, exactly why that is, I might be able to say a little bit more about in the next webinar that I'm going to do for you all, because I'm really going to be digging into the sense of
digging
smell
that more
as a sense. So I'm still investigating that, because while memory is my specialty, smell is not. But I used to work in an institute where they did a lot of research on smell, including some Nobel Prize winning research. So I'm going to be digging into that a little bit more. But I can tell you now that link with the limbic system has been very powerful, because episodic memories that are linked to emotional events tend to be more strongly encoded and more retrievable, which is of course the thing we can test. Do you remember this? And so smell seems to be very, very important as part of that mechanism. Now we're wandering back into my area of expertise for sure. I can smell, you know, I remember opening a magazine once and smelling one of those little cologne samples.
Oh yeah,
you know,
I remember that. Yeah.
That used to be in the foldouts. Now I'm aging myself, I think. And instantly having a memory of the last time I saw my ex-boyfriend who used to wear that same cologne.
I see. Yes.
And I tell you now, at the time, that was not a memory I wanted to retrieve. It just kind of came back up spontaneously. So, yeah, I think there's anecdotal truth to that as well as scientific truth to it.
Yeah, I thought actually how you talked about the evolution of you know, just kind of the evolutionary tree. And going back, I'm thinking those first single-cell organisms that to sense the world, the environment around them, they're probably using some sort of chemical sensors, which is sort of related to smell. So I could see that. Okay, so cool. Like, just really cool stuff. Okay,
but now, I know I didn't quite answer your question, which I remember now. It was, what do our memories make us who we are?
Make us who we are. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I sort of got a little bit sidetracked into slightly related things. But I think what we're circling in on here is, yes, to some extent, in particular, these episodic memories, they do make us who we are, because these are the things that make us unique from one another. We're all formed on a very similar blueprint. Genetically, we're not identical to other humans in any way, but the things that really start to distinguish us from others and that give us that feeling of self, I think are episodic memories. Now, that's not a very scientific thing to say, but the scientific thing to say would be that this researcher, Tolving, who coined the phrase episodic memory, gave a lot of thought and analysis to this. And went as far as to say that organisms that have episodic memory are capable not just of having a sense of self, but also of understanding that the self that you are now is not the same self as you were in the memory. So we can tell the difference between ourself and a memory that we're having that includes ourself, and that we can also envisage future versions of ourself.
Yes,
that's a big deal. Right? That's a big deal.
Yeah,
and at the time that he came up with that, Tolving said very strongly in both editions of his book, the one that came out in the 70s and the one that came out in the 80s, that only humans can do this. And that's a very strong statement that a lot of people have been very interested in investigating. Is that really the case? Do animals have a sense of self like this that's formed from their episodic memories? So that's the more scientific leaning now as an answer to your question.
I love that answer. And I think about we, you know, genetically or you know, biologically speaking, we're humans, but we can't. No two beings can occupy the same point in space and time, so our perspective of the world is always different, and that is kind of what makes us who we are.
Right.
So now I want to follow a few things. I want to go back to a few things that you had mentioned before, like your. The Paris experience of with your band trip, and this was so a couple of things I want to ask you about is, one is, how does stress and arousal affect episodic memory? Okay, and then the second question, as a follow up, like, this is when you're back in, you were younger, right? Were you like in your teens?
I was.
Yeah. Now the other question is. At least it seems like for me, and it seems like for a lot of other people, a lot of very strong, vivid memories seem to come out of that childhood or when they're adolescence. And then as an adult, it's sort of a blur, you know, for the most part, it's a blur. But those memories of when I was younger are just so strong. And as you mentioned before, if we talk about Paris, it may elicit some of those feelings of that you had experienced before then. So that's what I find is kind of nuts. right? Just how you can think about something and then all of a sudden it triggers all these emotions in you. So please, I'm sorry, that was a lot there. Can you speak to that?
That's okay. Okay, so let's take these two separately and we'll see if they come together at any point. So let's start with stress and arousal. So yeah, stress and arousal are really important factors when it comes to forming memories, particularly these kinds of memories, which are my favorite kind to talk about, episodic memories. So when you're in a condition of high arousal, you can absolutely be more likely to encode these kinds of memories. So your memory can be very much more primed, but at the same time, they may also become a little less accurate. So we tend to become more able to encode episodic memories in general, but we tend to encode fewer details. And so if you think about like really traumatic events or really, really stressful events, one example that I've used in the past, which is slightly less stressful to think about now, is 9/11. And the events surrounding 9/11. So people who were both present there and people who were tuning in and worrying about it from elsewhere have very, very strong memories of those events, but very, very poor memory for the details surrounding those events. Up to this stage that when I was talking about false memories before, there's a collective false memory around 9/11, which is that many, many people remember the news broadcasting footage of both towers coming down. But actually, the footage of the second tower coming down was not broadcast in real time. It was broadcast later. They held back that footage because they didn't want to create more panic. Wow. At least I believe that was the reason. Again, that might be a false memory. There was a reason why they held back that footage. And they didn't broadcast it in real time. I certainly remember seeing it unfolding in real time on my computer screen where I was watching it. I was in the UK at the time. But I can remember all these details about where I was, who I was with, etc., etc. But I can't remember maybe some small important details like that one. So it has these sort of dual effects. So if you want to remember things, being in a high state of arousal, stress, excitement can be really good. But I wouldn't recommend trying to learn something very detailed and difficult during that time, because your memory for details becomes very blurred, and you're not able to encode those like small details anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, as a dog trainer, one of the things I always tell my clients is this. It's a very simple thing: is we take care of the emotions first, and then everything else is just teaching tricks. And what I mean is that dogs, working with dogs, when they're very stressed or when they're very aroused, okay. So we're talking about, just to make it simple, positive valence or negative valence, in terms of like how aroused they are. So I always feel like, there's not much learning that's going on when they're in that state of arousal, and we have to bring them down to a, this is a term from Suzanne Clothier, which is bring them into the think and learn zone, thinking and learning zone. I could see, right, how that stress and arousal affects episodic memory. So, like, but why does it? That's my question. Like, why does it affect our memory? Why do we have trouble remembering those little details, like at 9/11, that of what you just mentioned of the broadcast of the towers falling down?
Yeah, right. Good question. One quick thing as well is that when we're training dogs, we're not only training their episodic memories. In fact, whether dogs have episodic memory is hugely debated, because, of course, we can't ask them about that kind of memory. We have to come up with clever ways to test it that may or may not indicate that they have it. So we're also talking about other forms of associative learning, right? We're trying to teach dogs associations. Maybe we're teaching them the name of something, a particular association between a command and something we want them to do. There's all of these other kinds of associative learning that are happening at that time, and that they are not necessarily more conducive at all during high arousal. So yes, it's true that those episodic memories, where the brain areas that are involved are closely linked to our limbic system, might be better encoded. But actually, other forms of associative learning don't really employ the limbic system to the same degree. And so the animal in that case might not be learning the thing we want them to learn at all. If we're trying to teach them other forms of associative learning and they're employing different brain regions entirely, then they might not be primed to learn a thing. However, they might learn fear memories, and fear memories have a very overlapping neural substrate with episodic memories, including areas like the amygdala, which is very important for fear or threat-based memories. And so it's entirely possible that not only will the dog not learn the trick or the command or whatever, I'm not supposed to use the word command, I'm at the cue, I think is the right word to use it. Let me start that sentence again.
You sound like me talking to my clients, actually.
So it's the case potentially that not only will the dog not learn the trick or the cue association that we want them to learn, but actually they may learn an association between the environment that they're in or the cue that we're providing them and the fearful or threatening situation that's happening. And those memories are very, very sticky. They're very easily and quickly encoded, very rapidly encoded, and they're very, very difficult to shift, as we all know. So, just a little aside on that, I think, that episodic memory is not the only kind of memory, and it's certainly not the only kind of memory we use when we're training dogs.
I see, yeah. And just as a quick example, I have a client whose dog, they had worked with another trainer before who used more aversive methods and aversive tools, like a shock collar or a prong collar. Mm. We were trying to teach her dog just a simple behavior of stay, which the dog has learned before with the other trainer. Now, when I give the cue for stay, the dog is actually responsive. When the owner does the cue for stay, she runs away, runs upstairs to the bedroom. And it was like we have to teach her a completely different cue for that. The thing that I think of is she experienced so much trauma from that. I believe that's where it came from, because that's where she said that's where things kind of changed, that the dog experienced so much trauma from that experience of trying to be taught something that she now just when the owner gives a cue stay, she runs away.
Right, and that can be what we call a single exposure learning experience. That is, the animal only needs to experience that connection one time.
Yeah,
it's adaptive, okay. Right? If we're in an environment, let's say I'm a mouse, I'm out in the world, and I experience a predator coming down to grab me, maybe a hawk, it comes really close. The shadow of that hawk coming over me, and the terror of that situation, whether I get grazed by the hawk's claws or no, if I survive that situation, it's highly adaptive for me to immediately freeze, hide, flee, you know, have one of those autonomic fear responses. Mostly mice who tend to be prey animals will freeze so that they can't be as easily seen because they're not moving anymore. So it's incredibly adaptive. That mouse doesn't want to wait for several hawk attacks before it learns that freezing behavior, because it wouldn't be adaptive at all. Now, we're all animals that share common genetic ancestry with those mice, right? Dogs are, we are. So we have all retained, evolutionary speaking, the ability to form these things with a single exposure, one trial learning. So there are so many, hundreds, maybe thousands of studies on mice who, you know, have really, really similar brains to the rest of us mammals, showing that if you put a mouse into an environment and you pair a cue, like a light, a sound, with a small electric shock, that the mouse will experience freezing behavior, will exhibit its freezing behavior, its natural avoidant behavior, after experiencing that shock paired with that cue one time. So put a shock collar on a dog, give the cue stay, shock the dog if it doesn't do what it wants. If those are paired closely enough in time, that's what you've taught the dog.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now just going along with that, now I work in an animal shelter, and there's a large population of our dogs in the shelter, which are adolescent dogs, between 6 months to about 2 years of age or so. Many, you know, most of the dogs we have at the shelter are in that age range, and that's very typical because that's where things with the behaviors of dogs get worse a lot of times, where we say, you know, it usually gets worse before it gets better, like you have that naughty teenager. Now I this is another thing that, you know, as trainers we've been taught, and you know, something I've heard as well, is that there is a sensitive period during the adolescent stage where fear learning, where fearful memories can be imprinted, really, I guess, sometimes I'm not even sure if this is the right term, but it's hardwired quickly. Now, so I want to ask you, why? Is that true? Is that why? And, you know, what kind of mechanism is responsible for that?
So, yeah, I'll start with this term hardwired, because I think it is helpful to talk about the mechanisms by which memories are formed. So we've talked a lot about some brain areas so far, and I'm going to come back to brain areas as a concept when we talk a bit more about adolescent brains. But in addition, it's not really enough for us just to know that brain areas are active during the formation of memories, because presumably, if that activity happens during the formation of the memory and then doesn't happen again, it's not very useful. And it wouldn't be very energetically efficient for the brain to constantly have those areas being active all of the time throughout our lives to hold memories online. So brain activity is very unlikely to be and hasn't really been shown to be the underlying mechanism for memory. So it turns out that most of the mechanisms we think of for long-term memories, memories that last for more than a few seconds or minutes, are kind of hardwired. So those tend to be the number of receptors, so the part of a neuron that can receive a signal. So neurons, the way they communicate with each other, there's a small gap between pairs of neurons, and there needs to be a small piece of chemical signal that passes between them, the synapse, right? Apologies to all those who know this already, but it's good to be clear. Interestingly enough, the synapse is probably another really evolutionarily conserved thing, because chemical signals were such an early stimulus in the environment. So we still have these residual synapses. It's not an electrical connection from one neuron to the next. There's a little chemical past, and we need receptors to receive that. So one physical substrate of memory is that the receptors themselves can be more easily triggered by the chemical being passed. Another one is that there can actually be more receptors. The cell can make more receptors and put them into the synapse waiting to receive. The prior cell can make more of the chemical. So that's another way that it can happen. There can be more of those pairs of neurons could be coupled together. I think everybody at this point has heard the phrase cells that fire together wire together. So that comes from a lot of work done by Donald Hebb and others. Hebbian learning and memory is this like physical chemical set of changes that's happening that causes two neurons to become more likely to interact with each other, where one can trigger the next one's firing the action potential, which is what sends the message along the neuron's length to reach the next one, and so on. So there's real, you know, chemical processes happening here. And for some forms of long-term memory, there's also the formation of proteins, new proteins that are, when I'm not 100% sure if we even know exactly what these new proteins are doing, but we know they're essential for the laying down of long-term memories. So when you say hardwired, you're right. You're right. Our memories are hardwired into us. Now, does that mean they can't be changed? No. The brain is plastic. And maybe we'll have a couple of minutes to come back to that before we end the conversation.
Yeah.
To talk about, you know, how we can actually potentially change memories, even these very, very hardwired emotional memories that can be very quickly encoded and very sticky, very difficult to get rid of. So yes, hardwired. And then the other part of the question is about adolescence being this critical period for the laying down of these emotional memories. So let me see if I can remember this research correctly. So there's lots of research out there, but the research I'm thinking of comes from a lab at Columbia University, where I worked for a long time and still consult. The researcher in charge of the lab, her name's Nim Tottenham. She's the chair of psychology at Columbia University. And she's done a lot of work on adolescent brains and the circuitry. So of those neurons that are getting hardwired together, what's really changing in the adolescent brain that can maybe allow some of these types of memories to be formed? And that sort of perpetuates particular kinds of adolescent behavior. So now I'm testing my own memory. It's been a little while since I read any of her papers, but the studies I'm thinking of, she was really looking at the wiring between some critical brain areas. One of them we've talked about before, it's the amygdala. That area that's really critical in sort of threat-based and fear-based memory formation. Not that that's all it does by any means. Another area is the striatum, which is very important for lots of different functions, including memory formation. In particular, the less conscious forms of memory formation, habit formation, also reward-based learning, which, as we know, is the basis for large amounts of our associative learning. So the striatum is a big complex that contains areas for both. And then areas of the prefrontal cortex, that's the part of the brain that is perhaps the most recently evolutionarily evolved. And so it tends to be bigger in humans and apes and monkeys than in other species, but it's present in cats, dogs, mice. We all have some of it. There are neuroscientists who are going to tell me that mice don't have prefrontal cortex, but that's a very boring conversation for a different day. Let's just say that mice and other animals have highly evolved complex cortex that helps them to be in control of their actions. And being in control of your actions, developing strategies, now we're starting to see why, if the connection between these areas is forming, how there can be a real shift in whether you're driven, I'm going to really oversimplify a little bit here, whether you're driven by your emotional brain or you're driven by your rational brain. Now, please, anyone who's listening to this, don't go away and be like, there's an emotional brain and a rational brain and they're in different places. I just mean, are you more likely to perhaps have an emotion-forward way of responding or a rational-forward way of responding? That's what I mean. So in adolescence, that balance is really, really shifting. From a more emotional, reactive way of responding into a more sort of choice-based, cognitive-led decision-making phase. And so her research has shown that the coupling between these areas, the hardwiring of memories between these areas is developing over time. And she did a set of really cool, interesting studies involving music. And she was interested in knowing, do we encode more, remember more, relate more to music that we experience during adolescence than any other time. So what they did in the lab is they had people, they put people into a stressful setting. So for humans, a really great way to put humans in a stressful setting is ask them to do very hard math. And works every time, even for mathematicians, I guess, but they didn't recruit any mathematicians as far as I know. So they got these poor individuals who volunteered to do really hard math, and they gave them headphones and a choice of radio stations to listen to. And unbeknownst to the humans, one of the radio stations only played music that was popular from their youth.
Okay.
From their adolescent years. So for me, this would be the music of the 90s. If I was doing this study. And they did a similar study in mice, by the way. They didn't have them do hard math. They put them in a stressful situation, which for the mice was like an open, exposed kind of area.
Yes, of course. Okay.
And they had the mice orient themselves toward different areas. They were free to roam, and the mice oriented themselves by walking. The humans oriented themselves by changing channels to the music from their adolescent years. Even
if the people reported later that they didn't like that music at the time.
Okay.
So they were comforted by music from their adolescent years, regardless of whether they had a preference for that music. And they chose that in a stressful situation. And then when asked afterwards, they said, it made me feel better to have this music.
That's interesting.
Which is weird because I don't like it. I mean, some people did like it, but yeah. So it seems like we form a lot of meaningful preferences during our adolescence, perhaps because of the restructuring that's happening between these brain regions.
Exactly how
that's happening, I can't quite say, but that's certainly where the data and the studies are leading us at the moment.
Mm-hmm. You know, in a way, it kind of makes sense because it's sort of setting you up for your adulthood, and all the tools and skills that you may need moving forward into your adulthood.
Right.
So, do you? I don't know if you remember. Did the music have any effect on, you know, their performance in doing the math?
I don't remember. What a great question. I actually don't know if they tested that or not.
Yeah,
because I think they were testing preference. And so if they let people freely choose, I think they had too many people in the choosing music from their adolescence group. But I'll go back and check that afterwards because I'm curious.
I was just curious if the people who didn't like the music from them, but they chose to listen, if they did worse or better on the math. Who knows?
I wonder.
Yeah.
But, yeah, there could be a lesson there for us all, right?
Yes. Okay, well, I want to bring this back to the animals, to the dogs, and you know what we're doing here. And you touched upon part of that I think is so important to us, which is trying to change some of these memories that were hardwired, especially when it's related to fear and trauma. You know, that experience with my client's dog, with a trainer who wasn't using very kind methods of training, you know, I mean, that's something that, hey, you know, that's easily kind of resolved because it's just teaching a dog to, like, stay, okay? But there's a whole lot of other behaviors that dogs will exhibit and in real life, and that's really challenging to live with because of past experiences, whether it's a bad experience with other people or maybe with other dogs, other animals, or maybe it's a lack of pleasant experiences. So sometimes we call it under socialization, like the dog wasn't socialized enough with other dogs, so then they go out in the world and they start lunging and barking at other dogs. Now, In your webinar about memory, at the end, you suggested this something that I just kind of blew my mind, and I was like, okay, hold on here. Such a cliffhanger. But you started talking about forgetting memories, okay? So let's talk about forgetting a little bit now, okay? Now we've been talking so much about memory. And I understand there's research now that suggests there may be a way to disassociate previously learned, like, fear memories. Is that what you were talking about in that webinar, in the end of that webinar?
So I think I covered a couple of different things there. I definitely talked about forgetting very quickly at the end. We quickly ran out of time there, so perhaps there's another webinar in there somewhere. And forgetting, I think, is still relatively poorly understood. It does seem to be difficult to measure, again, whether we're forgetting initial memories or whether we're just having trouble recalling and retrieving those memories. But what I really want to latch onto, because I think it's most relevant here, is the idea of these emotionally charged memories, and whether or not it's possible to improve something about them. And the research that's out there suggests that actually forgetting, it's not a good thing to pin our hopes on. So let's go back to our example of the poor old mouse who learned to associate that light with the shock and now freezes every time it sees the light. We can keep presenting the light to the mouse in absence of the shock, And eventually, it's possible that the mouse will stop freezing in the presence of the light. That process is called extinction. I'm sure you've heard of that before as
yes.
a trainer.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's really a slow process by which you just repeatedly associate the light with not with the shock, and hope that the animal learns that it's now safe. And sometimes that works, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it works very slowly. Sometimes it works, you know, during the session, but then afterwards, somehow the animal seems to go back to that again the next time that you work with them. So it's really a not incredibly reliable way of getting an improvement in the situation, which is that you don't want your animal to be responding, you know, in fear to something that isn't a fearful stimulus, or doesn't need to be a fearful stimulus. And of course, in humans, we know, and this may very well be true in our animals, we just can't ask them. We know this can go much further, in the sense that people with post-traumatic stress disorder, or post-traumatic stress, because it's not even disordered, it's quite adaptive to have this behavior as well, can really have this intrusive, you know, intrusive things happening even in the absence of the stimulus itself. So sometimes just having you know, these flashbacks and things happening almost in the absence of any trigger. And it's clear that extinction is not enough, because it doesn't matter how much time passes, people are still suffering with this. So what's the solution? So there's tons of great research out there now. Some of the earlier research here was done by a few researchers that I know. So I like to talk about their research. And one of them who's been featured a lot, and you could look up her research, is Daniela Schiller, who used to work in the laboratory of a researcher named Joseph Ledoux. He's very, very famous in working in the fear world. And Daniela's research and others in the lab really centered around sort of what are these connections that are being made, and is there any way to ameliorate this? And so essentially, one thing that this group of researchers have found over time is that it's possible to make a memory more vulnerable when you're retrieving the memory. So if you have a mouse that's been given a light and a shock, and you have the animal in that situation again with the light where it's freezing up, and then you do something to change that, you give something rewarding at the same time, it's actually possible to disrupt that fearful light coupling. And the memory essentially becomes more labile or more prone to disruption during its retrieval. And then if you compare it with something else, you can change the association. So we're not extinguishing the original association. We're sort of shifting the association to be with something else. And so on the one hand, you know, initially people were like, whoa, that's completely unethical. We can't be like having people retrieve these traumatic memories. Or animals retrieve these, you know, so
yeah.
Even saying the word stay, you might just be like, no, I'm going to, you know, choose another word for this animal.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, it's actually possible to disrupt that association during the retrieval of the memory. And another postdoc in Joe Ledoux's lab, Karim Nader, went a little further and tried to figure out what's the mechanism for that. And he's the person who discovered that giving a blocker drug that prevents that protein formation that I was talking about before, that hardwiring during the retrieval of a memory in these mice. Again, let's not make too many jumps to dogs or humans right in this moment, but he showed that actually giving a blocker that prevents that protein formation from happening caused that memory to be more quickly replaced by other memories, to be shifted, to be changed.
Wow.
Again, not necessarily forgotten, but that dynamic can be shifted or changed. So it may not be the case that we can erase those memories, but it might be the case that we can shift the emotional valence of them.
Okay.
And maybe that's all we need. Maybe that's better. You know, one of the questions I have been asked before is it ethical to erase memories? And firstly, we really can't do that.
Yeah, it right sounds now. Like science fiction type stuff, you know, right?
We don't do that actually. Yeah, okay. We don't do that. We can't do that. People are interested in lab mice and labeling neurons that are part of a memory, and then maybe trying to turn off their activity briefly to prevent memory retrieval from happening in a moment. That's very different from erasing a memory. It would only happen when you kind of interrupted that group of neurons firing for a brief moment, and then they would go right back to remembering again. So one, it's impossible. Two, it's probably unethical. You know, there was that film a few years ago, The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yes, I was thinking of that. Yeah, exactly.
Right, where this person makes the decision to erase all of their memories of their ex. What if they could just, instead of remembering the bad things, remember the good? What if they could change it to just a completely neutral emotional valence? Doesn't even have to be positive necessarily. So that's where the research has been leading that field, that when retrieving the memory, difficult as that is happening, then the memory becomes more vulnerable, more labile, more changeable, and then they can shift that association away from that really intense fear or threat into a more neutral phase. So they showed it in the lab initially by bringing people in and giving them a little electric shock when they saw a blue square, and then showing them the blue square again, but associating it with something else. And now people are starting to use that in therapy and in patients to really try and see, is this going to make life better and easier for people with these fearful, threat-based memories?
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's so fascinating. I mean, with all the trainers that are listening to this right now, they're thinking about the dogs, the very fearful dogs that they're working with, and the work that we're doing, which is a lot of times we are exposing a dog to a certain stimuli that does produce some sort of fear-related behavior, and then we're exposing them hopefully at an intensity where they're not being triggered, as we say, but we are feeding them treats, or we're giving them lots of praise, and we're playing, doing something pleasant for them, reward, and that's what we're trying to do, try to change that behavior. And so this is more recent research that's suggesting that there could be something that we could give the animals that could block the protein that is involved with the hardwiring of the fear, is what you're saying, when they're exposed to the animal, whatever trigger that is.
I would say watch this space. So of course, one of the big concerns outside of a lab animal here will be, what else does that protein formation blocker block?
Block, okay, yeah.
So sometimes it's the case that things don't only happen in the brain, and they don't only happen in one area of the brain when they do. And it's possible that giving that protein formation blocker, as it currently is understood in the lab, isn't the best solution, because it might lead to some problems down the line. Maybe we've blocked some other things that we didn't want to block.
That we need, that could be adaptive.
Yeah, right? In brain body. I would always be very cautious of anything coming out of the lab environment that seems to operate at sort of a whole body level. But it's really interesting research to watch, and there may even be newer research that I haven't followed since those studies came out, where people are working on more sort of targeted, deliberate things, or where people have been trying to figure out whether those protein blockers have other functions, whether they do have a really specific function, and it could be useful for that. But in the meantime, that positive reinforcement training and those positively valenced rewards that you all are using while you tread that line between being triggered and that's what you're doing. You're disrupting those memories when they're at their most labile, And starting to change that emotional valence of that association. So you're doing it even without the protein blockers. And now you know why.
Yeah, that's so cool. Neuroscience words. Yeah, even the lab studies, it kind of points to a bit of what's possible, right? Mm. And you know, so we keep studying and we keep learning and we just try to figure out, you know, how this all works. So it's right. Really so fascinating. Okay. All right. So I think it's time to wrap things up. But before we go, okay. So where can people find you? You know, where, you know, where your website, is that the best place to find you?
Yes. So my website, paulacroxon.com, is where you can find everything about me from my research to the other public events about science that I do, to even my music. you can find all kinds of ways to find me. I quite often participate in interesting, fun science events and storytelling events. So if you liked what you heard and you want to check out some of those, many of them are virtual and you can live stream them from anywhere or watch back later. So even if you're not in New York City, you can access those. You can also find me on social media. I'm at Paula Croxon on most platforms. Yes, I also definitely encourage folks to check out the Story Collider podcast, where we have two new stories every week that are really accessible, enjoyable, personal stories about science, both from scientists and people who would say they're not scientists at all. My role there is more behind the scenes, so I produce many of those stories and work with the storytellers to get them out into the world.
It sounds so cool. I'm going to check these out. And you're also, you already did the memory webinar, which was called the Neuroscience of Memory. Am I correct?
I forget what the title was. That's right, the Neuroscience of Memory. Yep.
Okay. And I can post that link up. And then you're doing two additional webinars for us, right?
At least. So I actually just did one.
Or more.
I just did one in January last week that was called The Neuroscience of Communication.
Oh, okay.
That one's just came out and will still be available after the fact. In February, on February 17th, I'm going to be doing The Neuroscience of Smell.
Yes. I know we talked that before.
A tiny bit about smell. I'm going to be really digging into that and the links with memory in that webinar. Hopefully I'll be doing a couple more after that as well. One about animal intelligence in March. One about the aging brain. I'm thinking I was teaching old dogs new tricks.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to have to get you back again for that one. My dog is 16.
Oh, so
talk to you about that a little bit
more. I'll be looking into the aging brain and all of its ways in April. And then potentially we'll also, if behavior vets keep me around, we may also dig back into that topic of adolescence. And the teenage animal brain. In some future webinars as well. But definitely the first one to check out, which hopefully will be very interested to all folks interested in dogs, will be the smell one on February 17th.
Cool. I am looking forward to that. I would love to have you on again to talk more. This was fun. It was a great experience. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Hey, animal lovers. Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard and like to learn more, please follow us on Facebook or visit www.behaviorvet.com. We have much more cool stuff for you if you'd like to keep geeking out on companion animal behavior with the Behavior Vets team. Come back soon and join us on our journey to make life better for the animals in your life. Thanks again for listening. Remember to have hope because real change is possible and we can achieve it together. Enjoy our podcast, but this is a reminder that the contents of this podcast are for educational and entertainment purposes only. The comments and advice are never intended to be a substitute for seeing a behavior professional or a credentialed veterinarian in person. While the content is always intended to help people receive the best possible behavior support for their pets, any information you utilize from this podcast is at your own risk.